Stay tuned for Africa News Tonight, coming up right after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Joe Palca reporting. According to a new report, Syria and Russia have been targeting hospitals. Amnesty International has accused Russian and Syrian forces today of deliberately targeting Syrian hospitals and medical facilities with airstrikes to ease the path for pro-regime ground forces advancing on northern Aleppo. Tirana Hassan, the humanitarian group's crisis response director, said over the last 3 months, Syrian and Russian forces have been deliberately attacking health facilities in flagrant violation of international humanitarian law. But what is truly egregious, she says, is that wiping out hospitals appears to have become part of their military strategy. Amnesty International said it had compelling evidence of attacks on six healthcare facilities that killed three civilians, including a medical worker, and injured 44 others. As to the ceasefire itself, well, the UN Special Envoy for Syria, Stefan de Mistura, commented earlier today in Geneva.
In general, the cessation has been holding. This is good news for many Syrian people. Unfortunately, we have to admit, like in every cessation of hostility or ceasefire, and in particular in this one, there are still a number of places where fighting has continued, including parts of Hama, Homs, Latakia, and Damascus. But they're being contained.
Police in Turkey. Shooting at two women held up in a building in Istanbul as they used guns and grenades to attack a police station. Both women were killed. There were no reports of any injuries in the attack. The identity of the two attackers was not immediately known. This is VOA News. The United Nations reports more than 3 million people in rebel-controlled areas of eastern Ukraine are struggling to survive and vulnerable to human rights abuses, including arbitrary arrest, detention, torture, and disappearances. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from Geneva on the latest UN report on human rights in Ukraine.
The report notes that the number of civilian casualties in eastern Ukraine has decreased over the past few months, but the UN Human Rights Office warns the ceasefire in the region is shaky, with repeated violations reported. Gianni Magazzini is chief of the Americas, Europe, and Central Asia branch of the UN Human Rights Office. He says monitors from the Organization for Security and Cooperation in Europe, working on Russia's side of the border, document hundreds of ceasefire violations every day.
On a daily basis, there is still crossing of about 9,500 and more individuals. Some of them are also in military-style clothing.
Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Latest figures show more than 9,000 people have been killed and 21,000 injured since the conflict between Russia-backed rebels and the Ukrainian government began nearly 2 years ago. Afghanistan's chief peace negotiator says talks with Taliban-led insurgent groups are at a last opportunity for accord despite increasing violence during the past 6 months by armed opposition factions. VOA's Ayaz Ghul reports from Kabul on a rare on-the-record meeting with Afghanistan's deputy foreign Minister Hekmat Khalil Karzai.
Direct peace negotiations between Afghan government and Taliban delegates are expected to take place in neighboring Pakistan later this week. A four-nation coordination group has prepared the ground for the long-awaited talks. The chief Afghan peace negotiator, Deputy Foreign Minister Hekmat Khalil Karzai, says the four countries involved have prepared a roadmap that will ensure a sustainable and productive peace process.
This, I think, in the next two or three decades will be the last opportunity to have peace between these two countries and between peace between Afghanistan and the violent opposition.
Key Taliban leaders are sheltering in Pakistan, allegedly with the help of that country's spy agency, and the covert ties have long strained bilateral relations. Ayaz Ghul for VOA News, Kabul.
The four-nation coordinating group consists of Afghanistan, Pakistan, the U.S., and China. European Council President Donald Tusk has warned economic migrants not to come to Europe and other European states as they will no longer be a transit country. He made the remarks after meeting with Greek Prime Minister Alexis Tsipras in Athens. Joe Palca from Washington.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good evening and welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.
And I'm Hayes Wuhib coming up this hour on Africa News Tonight.
I want to appeal to all potential illegal economic migrants, wherever you are from. Do not come to Europe.
That's European Union Council President Donald Tusk speaking today about Europe's migrant and refugee crisis. Details coming up.
Also, the United States is calling on the government of Burundi to fulfill its promises and take steps to restore peace. And a social media campaign is encouraging Nigerians to buy locally made goods to help weather the global price drop in its top commodity, oil.
We'll have these stories, plus the sunny side of sports with Sunny Young, music from DRC, and our daily features. So stay with us. There's lots more ahead on Africa News Tonight.
Our top story this hour, the European Union Council President is appealing to what he calls illegal economic migrants to stop coming to Europe. Donald Tusk made the statement after meeting with Greek officials and prior to next week's emergency EU summit.
I want to appeal to all potential illegal economic migrants, wherever you are from. Do not come to Europe. Do not believe the smugglers. Do not risk your lives and your money. It is all for nothing. Greece or any other European country will no longer be a transit country.
That was EU Council President Donald Tusk. He issued the warning after meeting with the Greek Prime Minister Alexis Tsipras. The Greek leader was called for sanctions against any EU country that refuses to accept its share of refugees. More than 25,000 have been stranded in Greece. In the last 14 months, more than 1 million migrants and refugees have entered Europe, most of them through Greece.
Migrants who have been prevented from crossing the Greece-Macedonia border have taken up a new form of protest to draw attention to their plight. Migrants in the Greek town of Iodomina today blocked the tracks as a train headed from Macedonia to Greece. Reporter Philip Warwick is in Iodomina, where a camp for migrants and refugees have been established. He spoke to VOA's Jody Kepawa about migrants trying to reach the Balkans, beginning with today's protest.
Migrants and refugees basically organize a sit-in on the rail tracks. Now, they do this as a way of venting their frustration, and they do this also when there's a cargo train running up and down the border. So it's an effective way of actually protesting, getting their message across, because the moment they sit down, you have all the journalists and international media who gather around with their cameras and, of course, radio journalists, and they see that as a way of focusing their message across to the world as to, you know, what's going on the border. And then they shouted slogans such as, open the gate, Serbia, Serbia, we're just passing through. And that's been the case over the last couple of days.
So describe exactly where you are on the Greek-Macedonian border.
Well, I am about 1.5 miles east of a village which has about a population of 150, so I'm dead center in the Greek countryside. The refugee camp itself, when I arrived here, had about 5,000 people. Bear in mind, the camp was designed to hold 1,500 people. So 5 days ago, there was 5,000. 3 days ago, roughly 7,000. Yesterday morning, the number tipped over 10,000. And yesterday evening, 11,000. The camp is expanding exponentially every day. In terms of the surrounding area, you have rolling hills. A section of the camp is actually built on a refuse site. So not the, let's say, in terms of health and safety and concern for the welfare of the refugees, probably not the best place.
Do these protests have any effect? In other words, after these protests, do they open the border at all?
Well, that's a good question. From the clashes, you probably heard that on Monday, there were clashes where about 500 migrants stormed their way towards the rail gate. They pulled along the way a steel post and they tried to ram the rail gate down. The Macedonian border police and riot police and the army retaliated in trying tear gas. They closed the border there for quite some time, for over a day. So in terms of, say, demonstrations and people here trying to, say, get the message across, it has absolutely no effect when it comes to the border crossing being open or closed. We have to bear in mind that the reason why there is a bottleneck here is that countries up north, Austria, Croatia, Macedonia, Serbia and Slovenia, they recently signed a joint statement declaring a new tighter limitations on refugees when it comes to the Balkan route. So you have that situation there. So it's basically sometimes out of the hands of the Macedonian authorities, because that document, when it was signed with agreement with the Serbians and the Austrians, dictates how many migrants they can actually let through per day. Now, the agreed amount was actually 580. And yesterday and the day before, there had been about 152-200. So actually, half the amount of people that are allowed to get through into Macedonian are not getting through.
Now, you mentioned the camp. I'm assuming you're talking about the camp at Idomeni?
That's correct, yes, the Idomeni camp, refugee camp.
Would you describe conditions in the camp?
First thing you notice, no matter day or night, is that there's this, always a steady trickle of migrants entering the camp. Some only have, say, plastic bags. Others use their initiative and they, for example, get a lift from locals or use wheeled rubbish bins to carry their personal belongings. And you see children, young people scavenge the Greek countryside. So outside the camp, they go for a walk. They go to search for wood in order to light their morning fire. And every tent you see here, and I would say there are probably about 5,000 to 7,000 tents here, everyone has a campfire in the morning and in the evening. When it comes to the conditions here, sanitation, you have a number of NGOs working here on the ground, and they're trying hard to coordinate. But in terms of the camp itself, the size itself is limited. So there is a set amount of, say, toilets and washrooms to cater for 1,500 people. And as I mentioned, there are 11,000 here. So the services are stretched here in terms of getting the waste out from the camp itself. About 40 to 50% of the people here are mothers and young children, something that we haven't seen before when it comes to the camps. So you also have to take into consideration here babies, nappies, diapers, food as well, milk, powdered milk, those kind of food items which are in desperate need here. Queues here are very long when it comes to food. And people sometimes have to wait hours to get an orange, bread, a sandwich.
That's reporter Philip Warwick in the Greek town of Idomeni. He spoke to VOA's Jody Capua. Warwick says migrants in Idomeni are now seeking alternate routes around Macedonia. Meanwhile, French and British leaders are meeting today to discuss the migrant situation in Calais. France is tearing down an infamous camp there called the Jungle, where migrants had gathered to try to sneak into Britain. French officials have warned if Britain pulls out of the EU, it might end its border controls in Calais.
You're listening to Africa News Tonight live on the following frequencies, 15, 580 and 6080 kilohertz on the Voice of America. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.
I'm Yais Wuhib, 13 past the hour. Here's a recap of our top story. The European Union Council President is appealing to what he calls illegal economic migrants to stop coming to Europe. And we'd like to hear your thoughts on our story. You can write to us at African News Tonight, Voice of America, 330 Independence Avenue, Southwest Washington, D.C., 20237.
Reuters reports more than two dozen Angolans died in a flash flood in the southern city of Lubango today. The banks of the Capital River overflowed during more than 24 hours of torrential rains. More than 30 people, many of them children, are missing from a riverside market area of the city. Many residents had congregated there to wash their cars and bicycles.
A leading wildlife protection group says conflict in South Sudan has killed thousands of animals, including elephants, giraffes, and antelopes. The government of South Sudan and the SPLA in opposition signed a peace agreement in the capital of Ethiopia, Addis Ababa, last August. But there are still isolated incidents of fighting. In addition, armed groups on both sides are accused of killing wildlife to feed their troops. Paul Elkin is the Wildlife Conservation Society's program director for South Sudan. He gave an update on the situation to VOA's William Eagle.
Even from the very beginning of this fighting, both armies, the SPLA and the SPLA in opposition, that both of the armies used wildlife and systematic hunting to feed their soldiers. And that happened in a dry season of 2014 and dry season of 2015 as well. And that had a major impact, particularly on the Tiang migration. And, of course, these guys, and then we had cases where these different soldiers were linking up with commercial markets, and it turned in, it wasn't just a question of feeding the soldiers to do the fighting, it was actually for commercial gain. And during this time, we've been working with the Wildlife Service to cut down on that. And just last week, there was 19 SPLA soldiers arrested by the Wildlife Service with 62 antelope carcasses and 15 machine guns. And so we're in a situation now where, as peace is coming in and the ceasefire is taking place, some of these soldiers, some of private individuals are turning their guns on wildlife for commercial gain. And that's really what's striking right now. And that's the pressure we're dealing with.
What is the solution to this? Have you been in contact with representatives of the opposition and the government to talk about this issue and to find a way to resolve it?
Yeah, we've been in touch with both sides and all parties on this, including some of these other, there's various armed groups in the country. And, of course, they're quite preoccupied with their ceasefire and their deals and security. But we do see that there's sensitivity at the highest levels of both the government, of course, and then the opposition parties to work on wildlife-related issues. I think the problem now, of course, is getting this transitional government formed, and then I think we're going to get a lot of interest from both sides. We've also had some positive feedback from the commanders of the Army, of the SPLA, when this recent arrest was made, where they said, no, you're doing your job, we need to do it. But a lot more needs to be done. Obviously, there's a humanitarian crisis ongoing in the country. People are suffering, but now wildlife is suffering. It's suffering more now than it has been in the past 2 years. And another thing that we're seeing is also elephant poaching seems to be expanding, and also ivory trafficking. And not just this, this gets across borders. We also have illegal gold mining happening, private companies trying to come in. And so there's this sort of a vacuum of power right now, which has yet to be filled, and it needs to be filled fast. And once it is, we're going to be engaging with all sides of the equation, and hopefully they'll adopt basically a crisis action plan to save the wildlife in the country.
You were saying earlier to me that there's quite a potential by protecting wildlife to help develop local communities or the economy. Could you comment on that?
Yeah. Before this war broke out, we had actually had several international ecotourism companies which were interested in building the first tourism infrastructures and operations in both Boma Park and Bandingalo Park. We do think there is this opportunity that South Sudan, obviously, as security is put back in place, it can benefit from those jobs, from that revenue generation. And frankly, I think both the government and the opposition, they know that. And they've been there. They understand the importance of it economically.
Paul Elkin is the Wildlife Conservation Society's Program Director for South Sudan. He was speaking from Juba with VOA's William Eagle.
In related news, the wildlife conservation group Born Free USA has announced the completion of their second annual fur drive. The four-month-long campaign collected an estimated 400 fur items from around the world. They include some the organization say it found to be disturbing, such as a tattered rug made from a trophy-hunted mountain lion that included the claws and head. Adam M. Roberts is the CEO of Born Free USA and the Born Free Foundation. He spoke with me about their latest efforts to stop the poaching and trophy hunting of wild animals.
Born for USA had an amazing response this year to its Fur for the Animals drive, in which we asked members of the public all across the country to send us their old used furs, and then we repurpose those furs and send them to wildlife rehabilitation and rescue centers to provide care and warmth for orphaned young animals. This year we had about 400 donations. It was really amazing. The overall value of the furs was probably $750,000, and we're able to use this opportunity to take something that is really old and vile and antiquated and make it useful. So we're really happy about the turnout this year.
How was this year's drive different from last year's in terms of what was donated?
Well, I think this year we've seen two things happen. It's only our second year doing this, so we've had a greater response as members of the public are made aware of what we're doing. And actually, we've had people in Belgium and England want to donate furs as well. So it's really going global, if you will. But then also this year, we had some very peculiar items, or at least items that one wouldn't expect. Normally, you'd expect the mink coat or the rabbit or the fox. But this year we had some wildlife that came in that was unusual for us. We had a zebra pelt and mountain lion and bison. So we had some definitely new and interesting animals come in. Of course, that adds a whole new level of sadness to what we're looking at, just thinking about these magnificent animals that are being killed for their skins.
Do you think that you are making significant headway in your work in stopping the poaching and trophy hunting of wild animals?
We do, whether it's on the animal welfare side, things like fur trapping or fur farms, or on the wildlife conservation side, keeping wildlife in the wild and safe from trophy hunters' bullets, we are seeing incredible progress. And, you know, part of it is that in this case, you've got people sending us their fur that we're able to use practically, but then at the same time, you've got legislation introduced in the United States Congress to end barbaric trapping on national wildlife refuges. And at the same time, you've got furriers stopping the carrying of furs and designers like Hugo Boss, stopping the production of fur garments. So overall, all of these things together, I think, suggest that we're making significant headway in our attempt to save fur bearers from cruelty.
Also, you mentioned outside of the United States, there were other countries who were very interested in giving their donations as well. So how do you think the world is responding to your efforts?
Well, globally, you know, there's a fur-free alliance that looks at these issues on an international scale and has a very strong presence in Europe, trying to get individual EU member states to enact stricter regulations about fur farms and get fur farms closed throughout Europe and regions like Scandinavia. And that's having significant success. So there is this global support for trying to stop animal cruelty and protect animals in the wild where they belong.
What is the next big effort on your agenda?
Well, for Born Free, we have, you know, obviously a significant portfolio of wildlife advocacy work. This year is going to be the 17th meeting of the Conference of the Parties to the Convention on International Trade in Endangered Species, or CITES, which is being held in September down in South Africa. And that'll be a two-week conference where we'll look at increasing protection for lions and maintaining protection for other species like rhinos and elephants, and then also looking at new species that haven't really been on our radar very much, like the pangolin, where there are four pangolin species in Africa and four in Asia, and they all warrant protection because right now they're probably the most illegally trafficked wild animal in the world. So there's a lot of these individual cases that we're looking at and gearing up for the CITES meeting. That'll be one of the big focuses for Born Free in the coming months.
Adam M. Roberts is CEO of Born Free USA and the Born Free Foundation. He spoke with me from Washington.
The United States is calling on the government of Burundi to fulfill its promises and take steps to restore peace. The State Department has issued a statement urging the government to implement President Nkurunziza's promise to release at least 2,000 detainees. It also calls on Burundi's leaders to lift all restrictions on media, create conditions for citizens to safely express dissenting views, and drop charges against political opponents and release them. In regard to the East African Community Summit in Arusha, the U.S. says it looks forward to the EAC immediately announcing a date for the resumption of dialogue with all stakeholders inside and outside the country.
Benin goes to the polls to Sunday to choose a new president, and the ballot is long, a record 33 candidates. Incumbent Thomas Boni Yayi is stepping down after serving his maximum of two terms. Emily Iob reports from Abidjan.
One frontrunner among Benin's nearly three dozen presidential candidates is current Prime Minister Lionel Zinsou. Zinsou helmed a coalition of three political parties. It is a distinct advantage, said regional political analyst and director of the Wati think tank, Jiriabi. He says Dinsu has the support of political parties that were considered to be in the opposition, and he also has the support of the ruling party, so that gives him a certain political weight. But Yabi says it is still anyone's race. He says it is a very open election, and there are other candidates who could gather a larger number of votes. Dinsu has faced criticism over his ties to France. The investment banker was born and raised there and has only recently returned to Benin. He was named prime minister last June. His top challenger include food industry magnate Sébastien Ajavan and cotton tycoon Patrice Talon. Talon broke with President Boni Yayi after he accused Talon of trying to poison him. Talon only returned to Benin last year following a presidential pardon. Analysts say the candidates have, for the most part, been raising the same top campaign issue like corruption, jobs and agricultural reform. If no candidate wins a clear majority Sunday, Benin will hold a runoff election 2 weeks later. Emilia for VOA News in Abidjan.
A social media campaign is encouraging Nigerians to buy locally made goods to help weather the global price drop in its top commodity, oil. While many have embraced the campaign, some think Nigeria will need to do more to kickstart its slowing economy, the largest in Africa. Christine has more from Lagos.
The campaign, symbolized by the hashtag #BuyNija to grow the Naira, was started by outspoken senator and entertainment mogul Ben Murray Bruce.
And I said the only way to solve our economic problem is to support made in Nigeria goods and services, because if we did that, some of the money stays here. We can support our people here. We've got great entrepreneurs in this country.
Oil makes up the majority of Nigeria's exports and government revenue. The price of a barrel is now about $35, down from around $100 just 2 years ago. That has slowed Nigeria's economic growth and also caused the value of the Naira to depreciate on the black market, even though its official rate remains stable. At his store in Lagos's Obalende Market, provision seller Sunday Emeka says he's seen prices of imported goods like rice rise by nearly 50% because of the currency's weakness.
Look at the bag of rice now. Bag of rice, last year, bag of rice was 10,000 naira. Because due to the importation of goods, they increased it to 15,000 naira, which is not right.
Ani Basi Ayo is an entrepreneur who started a food company that sells honey. When he was growing up, Basi Ayo says people weren't interested in Nigerian clothes or entertainers. But younger generations have changed that.
We have evolved, particularly with the Nollywood and entertainment industry setting the trend. I think it's now time for goods to transcend that sort of perception line.
But Chuba Ezekwesili, a research analyst at the Nigerian Economic Summit Group, the media campaign is short-sighted. Nigeria ranks near the bottom, 169th, on the World Bank's ease of doing business rankings. Its industries are hobbled by a lack of reliable electricity and slow-moving bureaucracy. A more sustainable campaign would put pressure on the government to fix these problems, he says.
It's so bloody expensive in Nigeria, you know, to produce or create. You know, the input costs are high. Electricity, water, transportation.
If the country had better infrastructure, Ezekwesili said, more businesses would be able to export other products, giving Nigeria's economy a cushion when oil prices fall. Chris Stein for VOA News, Lagos.
This is Africa News Tonight with Kim Lewis. I'm Yehi Suhib in Washington. It's 28 minutes past the hour on the Voice of America. For listeners on VOA's Nairobi FM station, please stay tuned for Swahili Evening News coming up at 16:30 UTC. For all other listeners, please stay tuned to Africa News Tonight for the latest sports, features, and more coming up next right here on VOA. For the full hour of Africa News Tonight, tune in again at 1800 UTC.
Hello, I'm Douglas Impoga. Join me for VOA's discussion program, Reporters Roundtable, every Thursday at 17:30 UTC. We'll have African journalists and expert guests share their ideas and take an in-depth look at an African news topic important to you. So please plan to be with us every Thursday at 17:30 UTC right here on VOA.
Her lyrics could be French,
English,
Portuguese,
Bantu,
Arabic, etc.
It is the beat,
the African beat that counts.
The beat does all the translations.
It cuts across all languages and gives us the understanding that this is the African beat.
It is so distinct
and adhesive.
It binds us together.
African beat on The Voice of America, Mondays through Fridays, 0900 and 2000 Universal Time,
with David Bandy.
This is Africa News Tonight on The Voice of America. Here's a brief recap of our top stories this hour. The European Union Council President is appealing to what he calls illegal economic migrants to stop coming to Europe. The United States is calling on the government of Burundi to fulfill its promises and take steps to restore peace. And Benin goes to the polls on Sunday to choose a new president. Coming up, we'll have music from the DRC, and in our feature segment, coping with the higher cost of living in South Sudan. I'm Kim Lewis with Yehia Spuhib, and we're live from Washington. This is Africa News Tonight on the VOA. Sports with Sunny is next. And of course, it's time now for the Sunny Side of Sports with Sunny Young. Happy Thursday, Sunny.
Happy Thursday to you, Kim.
Well, Sunny, I understand your starting line is African Athletics.
Kim, the Sunny Side of Sports spotlight shines this evening on Gabriel Mvumvure, a 28-year-old sprinter from Zimbabwe who was on the comeback trail after being hospitalized last year with kidney disease. Gabriel was a student athlete at Louisiana State University in Baton Rouge here in the USA, where he was a member of the track team from 2008 to 2011. Now Gabriel has his sights set on the IAAF World Indoor Championships later this month in the northwestern U.S. city of Portland, Oregon. And after that international competition, Mvumvure hopes to compete at the Rio Olympics in Brazil. The VOA's Daybreak Africa sportsman Marco Uma tells us more.
Former Africa Junior 100-meter and 200-meter champion Gabriel Mvumvure is the only Zimbabwean to qualify for the IAAF World Indoor Championships due in Portland, Oregon State in the United States of America in a fortnight. A beneficiary of the Worldwide Scholarships Initiative, Mvumvure recently triumphed in 60 meters in 6.64 seconds in Baton Rouge, Louisiana State in the United States of America to earn a ticket to Portland. He is on a comeback trail following a year out of action due to a life-threatening ailment. Mvumvure begins with a recollection of his experience last year.
I had a rough year last year. I was sidelined from track and field because of hypertension and chronic kidney disease. I was admitted in hospital. It was a rough year. All my life, I never spent a day in hospital, and it was basically a new experience for me. It's what my body had gone through. It was much harder to come back from it, you know, within a short space of time. And in my workouts now, I'm smarter. I've always believed that setbacks could be huge comebacks, and stumbling blocks could be stepping stones. And right now, I feel like my stumbling block is a stepping stone because I've officially qualified for the World Indoor Championships. The last time I was there in 2014, I missed making the final by, I think, 2 spots. And whenever you make, you know, the least amount of mistakes, eventually you will win. So that's the same way I approached my race in Baton Rouge. I still believe that, you know, there's room for improvement. And as I polish things up, getting ready for World Indoor Championships, I think the times will come and I will get faster. My expectations is nothing less than gold. I know in the eyes of many it's impossible, but I also believe that I serve a great God. Nothing is impossible with Him. What is impossible with humans is possible with Him. I'm going for a gold medal. It is hard. I mean, if it was easy, everybody would do it. At the end of the day, there will be only one champion. There will be one crowd champion in Portland in the 60 meters, and I would love for it to be me. After Portland, really love to focus on 100 meters and 200. As Olympics this year in Rio, that would be a big one. I really want to qualify for Rio Olympics in the 100 meters and 200. Getting back my health, I'm getting back my groove, I'm getting back my speed. We'll see in Portland, March 17th to the 20th.
That was Gabriel Mvumvure, Zimbabwe's 2007 Africa Junior 100-meter and 200-meter champion, speaking in Baton Rouge, Louisiana State in the United States of America.
The Voice of America, VOA.
Friends, we can all listen to The Sunny Side of Sports.
Yes, my friend.
The Sunny Side of Sports.
Sunny Side of Sports.
The Sunny Side of Sports Show.
Great show, bro. This is Sunny Side of Sports.
Sunny Side of Sports.
Right here on the Voice of America.
Voice of America.
Stand up. Stand up. Stand up. Stand up.
What's better than the Sunny Side of Sports? More Sunny Side of Sports. Listen to our new expanded show now on VOA Africa.
Joining us again on the Sunny Side of Sports is our African football guru, David Legg. And David takes a look at some of the recent highlights in the CAF Champions League club competition.
Two teams that went into their preliminary round second leg matches suffering from, I think, a lot of frayed nerves were Mamelodi Sundowns of South Africa and Enyimba of Nigeria, because both clubs had lost their first legs away to Chicken Inn of Zimbabwe and Vipers of Uganda by 1-0. And as we said previously on The Voice of America, if you're going to lose away by 1-goal margin, it's always preferable to score some goals. Ideally, you want to lose 2-1 or 3-2 or even 4-3. 1-0 is a dangerous scoreline. But to the credit of Sundowns and Enyimba, they pulled through, both sides winning at home by 2-0. The Sundowns one, Sonny, was particularly dramatic. Wayne Aronsa scored for Sundowns after 35 minutes of the first half. So it was 1-0 on the night and 1-1 on aggregate. And that is how the score remained until 5 minutes into stoppage time, when Chicken Inn conceded a penalty. Now, they, of course, naturally, I suppose, said it wasn't a penalty. I've looked, Sonny, with, I believe, a very impartial eye at numerous slow-motion TV replays, and there is no doubt that a Zimbabwean foot made contact with a South African leg, and it was a penalty. It seemed to take an eternity for the penalty to actually be executed, but when it was, Katleko Mashego beautifully placed it right into the corner because the Zimbabwe goalkeeper dived in the right direction. So that kick had to be pinpoint perfect, and that's where it was. As soon as play restarted, the final whistle blew, so true drama at Atteridgeville, which is a township very close to Pretoria. Sundowns 2, Chicken Inn of Zimbabwe 0, Sundowns advance 2-1 on aggregate. It was slightly less tense for Enyimba. Udo scored from the penalty spot after 32 minutes, so 1-0 on the day, 1-1 on aggregate. And Udo became the hero, the toast of Southeast Nigeria, when he scored again after 61 minutes. And from then on, it was really a case for Enyimba protecting that 2-goal advantage, which they successfully did. But a close shave, Sonny, 2-0 on the day, 2-1 on aggregate, and a really fighting performance by the Vipers of Uganda, making their first appearance. And unfortunately, they had to go into these matches against Enyimba without their star, that's Farouk Maya. He formerly played for the various Ugandan national teams, but he was injured during the CHAN competition. And he's now off to Standard Liège in Belgium, so he missed those two games against Enyimba. While Enyimba were celebrating in West Africa, I'm afraid Ashanti Gold of Ghana were not. They had a slender 1-0 lead over Mouloudia Bejaia of Algeria going to North Africa. Bejaia took the lead at home. Ashanti Gold equalized, so 1-1 on the night. And it meant that Bejaia had to score twice more. And that's exactly what they did. They scored twice in quick succession, midway through the second half. So Mouloudia win 3-1 on the night and 3-2 on aggregate. A team from West Africa that were hoping to cause an upset were Gamtel of the Gambia. They had lost only 2-1 away to Kouribga of Morocco. It was 1-1 with 18 minutes left. Gamtel needed a second goal to force a penalty shootout, but unfortunately it was the Moroccans who scored a second time, right at the death. So Kouribga winning 2-1 on the day and 4-2 on aggregate. I despair, Sonny, of Kenyan football. They just cannot get the victories that we expect them to achieve. Gor Mahia, the pride of Nairobi, were up against Knaps Sport of Madagascar. Now, Malagasy clubs have got a really poor record in CAF competitions in recent years. And last year, Gor knocked out Knaps, and I, for one, certainly expected that Gore would advance to the round of 32. But Gore were in big trouble after losing 2-1 at home in Nairobi. They went to Madagascar, that huge island state off the east coast, and Gore lost 1-0, so they go out 3-1 in aggregate. And I think Kenyan football supporters must be really disappointed, because that looked like a tie that Gore could win. In Zambia, Zesco United supporters will be full of joy. It's not easy to go to South Sudan and win, but Zesco did that. They beat Al Ghazala 1-0, and that followed up a 2-0 home victory. So Zesco advanced 3-0 on aggregate. After all the action, Sonny, we have the draw for the last 32 rounds. Some people call it the first round, others the round of 32. Effectively, it's now the big boys, because the teams that had a bye in the preliminary round, like TP Mazembe, the holders, they're now in the competition. So let's go through those 16 ties. It's V Club of DR Congo against Ferroviario Maputo of Mozambique. Sundowns of South Africa against AC Leopards of Congo Brazzaville. Wari Wolves of Nigeria against Almarek of Sudan. Etoile of Congo, Brazzaville, against Anton Satif of Algeria. Vidat Casablanca of Morocco, or AS Douanes of Niger against Knaps of Madagascar. St. George of Ethiopia against TP Mazembe of DR Congo, the defending champions. Enyimba of Nigeria against Vitalo of Burundi. Kur Ibga of Morocco against Etoile Sahel of Tunisia. Stade Malien of Mali against Cotton Swore of Cameroon. Zesco of Zambia against Haroya of Guinea. APR of Rwanda against Young Africans of Tanzania. Lebolo of Angola against Al Ahly of Egypt. Kaiser Chiefs of South Africa against ASEC of Ivory Coast. Al Ahly Tripoli of Libya against Al Hilal of Sudan. Union Douala of Cameroon against Zamalek of Egypt. And Club Africain of Tunisia against Mouloudia Bejaia of Algeria. The first leg, Sonny, will be on March 11, 12, and 13. The second legs on March 18, 19, and 20. So on successive weekends, you'll have the first legs and then the second legs.
Thanks, David. That's our African football guru, David Legg, speaking with us once again from Johannesburg, South Africa. The World Golf Championships is teeing off today, Thursday, in Doral, Florida. There's some big prize money at stake, a total of $9.5 million, with the winner getting $1,620,000. South African star Louis Oosthuizen goes into the tournament fresh off his eighth European Tour title in Perth, Australia. Louis talked with reporter Nick Dye about winning in Australia.
That means a lot. It's been 2 years since I had a win last. I came close a few times last year. So, you know, you want to stay in the winning circle, and you want to keep that feeling of what it feels like. So I started really nervous this morning. Didn't feel like I hit any bad shots, but I just I got the wind wrong on the second, and hit it 2 yards too far on the third, and it, you know, ended up going one over through three holes. I needed to settle in, and then during the middle of the round I played nicely.
And you did say in advance of the final round that a three-stroke lead was nothing on this course. I suppose that was proved the case, wasn't it, through seven holes or so?
Yeah, well, definitely. I mean, you know, one is a very birdie below, and then you have the third, the par five, and there's a few out there that you can see someone going four or five under the front nine. So I knew I needed to play well, and when I got to the 15th, I knew just to hang in and... you know, just to give myself birdie putts and just keep on making pars should be fine. And left myself with a vicious first putt on the last hole, but I knew I had three shots. I think three putts. I think if I only had a one shot lead, I would have probably hit it in a different spot on the green. My second shot.
It's not bad for a first visit to Australia, is it? And I think you've probably got some thanks to Ian Baker Finch, Ernie Els, amongst others.
Yeah, it's. I mean, they told me I was going to love the golf course, and I do. I mean, it's such a great a track, and you know, it's one of my favourites. So I'll definitely be coming back here.
And you'll be aware what Ernie achieved here, what Retief Koosen has done here. It's quite something to join them, isn't it?
Yeah, it's nice. It's nice knowing that your fellow countrymen won here before, so hopefully we can keep it going.
Well, you touched on this, but in this part of the world, this is known as a long gap between drinks. It's been an eventful time, hasn't it, over those 2 years?
You mean with me playing?
With you playing and not quite getting the win.
You know, 2014 was still a bit struggling with a few things in my body, and 15 felt okay, better than 14. But to get close is one thing, to win it is something else. So doesn't matter how big the event is, victory is something that you can work from and really take to the next tournament and for the rest of the season.
And when you win pretty early in a year, does that bode well?
It does. My PGA Tour season basically starting in Doral, so it'll give me a massive boost to go there and know that I'm hitting the ball well, but I am going to be a bit jet-lagged, I know that, but you know, I'm looking forward to the rest of the season.
Well, we should celebrate this, but as you mentioned, Doral, will it be nice going back to a place where you finished top 10 last season?
Yeah, I like the golf course. It's always very windy, and I like playing in those conditions. So it will be a tough week. It's always a tough week, but looking forward to it.
South African golf star Louis Oosthuizen looking forward to the World Golf Championships, which tees off today, Thursday, in Doral, Florida. And Louis was talking with reporter Nick Dye in Perth, Australia. I'm VOA's Sonny Young, and that's the sunny side of sports. Back to Yahias Wuhib and Kim Lewis.
Thank you, Sonny. And listen to the sunny side of sports Monday through Friday at 16:31 UTC and 18:31 UTC. And on Fridays, Sonny has an expanded half-hour edition of the sunny side of sports at 17:30 hours UTC, right here on The Voice of America.
Coming up, coping with the high cost of living in South Sudan. But first, some music. Here is DRC's Fally Ipupa with Bankanja.
Iseboya lobina Bankanja. Bankanja kamata kwanga e. Iseboya lobina Bankanja. Bankanja kamata kwanga.
Bankanja, Bankanja, kamata mumbele. Ah. Nga bekinga inja mina ari mukristo nikamo yanga naye ikusuko pepa njakumba
bana nilinga la kondalo yeto tuleke samba mila champion
esthétique losa como kula ka José Ndundu toko so ikula toko so insanswa tuleke samba Aiko Nkiomba, Aiko
Nkiomba,
Aiko
Nkiomba.
Robert Lobota, Celebo Fango, Pele Mongo, Ajoli Beta, Commando Motote, Bokila Lokondo.
Mbandale loyo, Mbandale loyo, Kanga Biro Kona yo, Kende Panabino, Haribi Biniga Pusia. Mbatatara Bango ye, Matatara Bango, Balanza Simizi, Asika ye, Kanga Futo. Ay mama.
Alpha Ngongo Chateau d'Or,
Mita Harmonite, Motema ya Alpha Morflip. Jeannette Bonpetit, Bob et Mave, Atomé Tachabert, William Saïla, Dudjun Joli. Abe Kongo li aliao, Kongo njoyo lili, Kase Kongo li aliao, Fonoma, Kongo njoyo lili, Be Kongo li limboyo, Imbusa, Be Kongo jojo lubanzila yawe, Be Kongo maboza andi, De Champigny, Boulanga la José Ikote, Be Kongo sele wadido ye, Nakaluji Saint Valois, Kasha la Mula si papi boto, Alain Versas maître Matula, Pati Lomboto, Jado Mongombe, maître Manisia, Tuke Lomboto.
Sakanige Sakanzoto, Mama Kaniaka, Wanda, Wanda, Ale to Wanda, Ale to Wanda, Ale Mategeta, Ale Mategeta, Ale Mategeta, Ningeta Loketo, Ningeta Loketo, Kiesa Mokiesa.
Pacho Erefi Gelon Masungu,
Ale, Panami Bad, Tomona Bogo, Katin Simba, Texas Katadi, Yei Kenda. Daddy Matundu,
Wala, Ale to Simba, Ale to Simba Loketo, Nyata, Wala, Sakunda, Yak, Ale Mateketa, Ale Mateketa, Kesemo Yeso, Kesemo
Yef Kabamba,
Labasi, Atomola Meshi, Shiliwa Senga, Chuchuluambo, Mama Weaver, Kukutoya,
Wala, Ale to Simba, Ale to Simba Loketo, Nyata, Ale, Simba, Ale, Simba, Ale, Pukaluke, Ale, Pukaluke, Ale, Pukaluketo,
Aliato, voilà, c'est pas le guette, aliato, qu'est-ce que c'est, qu'est-ce que c'est. Allez, tout le monde, levez la main. Maître Kim, haute tension, Kevin Kassoua, Yves Abdallah, RDG, Yak, Divi, papa, attrape maman, maman peut attraper papa, touchez les réals. Touchez les réals, bougez les réals, bougez les réals, et tout danser, allez tout zinga le kidou, miata, allez tout bousa, allez tout wanda, qu'est-ce mon yeso, allez ma tegeda, allez ma tegeda, poisson amonda, poisson amonda, Sankara de gouta, blaise et l'aimant,
zinga le kidou, mwanda,
aniata, allez ma tegeda, voilà ma tegeda, allez, bisous yoso, top la musique,
boyo caribé, c'est 144 à Bruxelles,
ah, mais les gars,
Bibi Chateau pour maman na Alison, JR Milam. Jeff et Mabich. Jean-Jacques Kikela. Apocalypse.
DRC's Fally Poupa with Bakanja.
In South Sudan, some say they can't make a living with rising prices, while others say business is good. One South Sudanese farmer in Kajoki County in the newly created Yei River State says he earns tens of thousands of pounds a year in poultry farming. But he also faces many challenges, including the high cost of feed, which must be imported from neighboring Uganda. Waki Simon Wudu has more from Juba.
That is Swara Samuel instructing the relatives who work with him on his poultry farm to start the day's course. Samuel says he wakes up every morning before 7 o'clock and tells his relatives to feed the chickens. He makes sure the water containers are washed clean, the feeders are cleaned, and sick chickens are isolated from the healthy ones.
I started this project because of school issues. One time when I joined the college, I almost dropped out. But because of this small project that you see here, made me to finish the level that I was in. So I decided not to leave it because I've seen it's very important. It is what actually made me to be what I am today. So I decided to continue with the business and make it better to make sure that the children I have at home are also able to learn and pick from it to the extent that if I'm not around, they'll be able to work for themselves.
Samuel says his mother inspired him to work hard. He says when he was young, his mother used to keep chickens, which the family ate and sometimes sold to earn some money. Samuel's poultry house is comprised of 2 3-by-5-meter rooms built in his house from burnt bricks, iron sheets, and timber. Samuel has between 300 to 400 chickens. He says it's not easy rearing that many chickens, especially when it comes to buying the chicken feed.
Getting feeds locally here is difficult. I travel up to Uganda to get these feeds. Then now the transport cost and the buying cost and everything has become very expensive. One other challenge that we have is the issue of drugs. We don't get drugs locally here. If they're there, they're very expensive, but not also the quality that we really want. Most of the drugs we have here are not really the best quality.
Samuel says one bag of chicken feed costs him 1,100 South Sudanese pounds, which he buys and transports from Uganda up to Kajukeji. He says it is also difficult to get good quality chicks in Uganda. It can take at least 6 months for him to receive an order from his buyers. But the biggest challenge, Samuel says, is accessing U.S. dollars, which he needs to import supplies from Uganda or any other country. U.S. dollars must be then converted to Uganda shillings. Despite the challenges, Samuel remains determined to succeed.
We can't give up still because this is business. So even if I buy, or everything's all expensive. What I have to do is to calculate all the production cost and then I give some small profit margin. People will not stop eating chicken. Though things are expensive, they'll continue.
Samuel says it costs him at least 25,000 South Sudanese pounds to raise 200 chickens. When he sells the chickens, he earns about 42,000 South Sudanese pounds. Unfortunately, many South Sudanese view poultry farming as a dirty job. Samuel says two chickens pays the school fees for one child in his family. He uses the revenue from his poultry farm to pay for medical care and food. Samuel's wife, Abao Annette, says she has been able to enroll in a higher education course using money made from the poultry farm.
As this project began, I can see that the family has improved. The children are feeding well. Food is not a problem at home here. All children are now in school. That time when some of them are still at home, but now all of them are now in school. Secondly, also, I appreciate the project because my husband managed to send me to school through this project. So as now, I have finished my diploma in business administration through the help of the project.
But Annette acknowledges the work is not easy.
It has a lot of work to be done, especially water, fetching water, and the borehole here is far, and the chicken can eat a lot of things. And sometimes when, especially you can clean your compound, after a short time they can threaten it.
Speaking in her native language, neighbor Lillian Puru says Samuel's poultry has been good for the community.
So far, it helped us a lot as neighbors here. For example, if we want egg, we can get them at home here.
And Puru says she can even give chickens to visitors. For VOA News, I am Wake Simon Wudu in Juba.
This is African News Tonight on the Voice of America on the following frequencies, 15580 and 6080 kilohertz. Tune in to African News Tonight at 16 and 18 hours UTC, Monday through Friday. And with that, we wrap up this edition of African News Tonight. Up next, our VOA editorial. I'm Yehi Swuhib in Washington.
And I'm Kim Lewis. And for all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voaafrica.com. And on behalf of our African News Tonight producer, Bill Workinger, and our engineer, Curtis Bynum, thanks for choosing the Voice of America.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The U.S. Agency for International Development, or USAID, and the Coca-Cola Company have announced support for a new program in Nigeria under the Water and Development Alliance, also known as the WADA Project. The $2 million project will provide up to 100,000 citizens in Cross River State with access to safe drinking water and good sanitation facilities by 2019. This joint investment is aligned with USAID and Coca-Cola's shared focus on clean water provision as a means to help build healthy, sustainable communities in Nigeria. The U.S. government is committed to engaging in effective and innovative alliances with committed partners to support Nigeria's critical development needs, said William Stoyer, acting U.S. Consul General in Lagos. We are proud to collaborate with Coca-Cola to bring a sustainable and safe water solution to thousands of people in Nigeria, he added. During the signing event, USAID Mission Director to Nigeria, Michael Harvey, said, "Today we are consolidating a special partnership, one in which a private firm has joined with a U.S. government agency to contribute to a priority set by the government of Nigeria." USAID and Coca-Cola have collaborated in Nigeria since 2007. The partnership has improved water resource management and expanded sustainable access to safe drinking water and sanitation services in Kano and in Yugu states. The WADA project helps to control and prevent water-related diseases such as cholera, typhoid, and diarrhea by providing water and sanitation services, hygiene education, and establishing water, environment, and sanitation committees in communities where the project works. This new agreement will provide a framework to implement WADA and to allow the parties to establish a range of policy issues to achieve their shared objectives in Nigeria. The United States is proud to work with Nigeria and its international and private sector partners to give the Nigerian people better access to something all human beings need, safe drinking water.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Hello, I'm Douglas Impoga. Join me for VOA's discussion program, Reporters Roundtable, every Thursday at 17:30 UTC. We'll have African journalists and expert guests that share their ideas and take an in-depth look at an African news topic important to you. So please plan to be with us every Thursday at 17:30 UTC right here on VOA.